Okay. Welcome everyone. Thank you so much for joining the Pesach prep. Just one or two housekeeping ideas. The first is that this shiur was designed with the young professional community in mind, and so some of the particular cases or topics that I'll discuss are might be more geared towards the young professional community. That being said, if you're young at heart or professional at heart, or you thought this link was for something else but decided that you wanted to stay, please feel free to join in as well. If you have any questions that I haven't addressed, and for everybody, you can either use the chat feature. I'll try to answer them as they come in, or depending on what it is, wait till a later section. Or you can also please feel free to unmute at the end as well. Some people submitted questions in advance. Thank you. That was actually very helpful, both in terms of being able to tailor the shiur as well as to be able to look up questions in advance. And so people that submit questions now, I will try to do the best I can on the spot. That being said, I may not be able to answer everything, and Blina Nether, I will try to get back to you as soon as I can. Okay, so let us start. Pesach prep is probably one of the most intensive, I would say, preparations that we do as part of our Jewish lives throughout the year. It's very time consuming. Some of us may have started by Purim time. Some of us may have started a few weeks ago. Some of us have, may have not started yet. Regardless, it is a very intensive preparation. And if you look at this picture on the left, there's a range of emotions. Some people are very excited. Some people are stressed out. Some people have a tendency to get into accidents. There's a diverse array of reactions and feelings, and we have to try to be sensitive to everybody. The end goal is on the right, where everybody's sitting together at the Seder, whether it's friends, family, or just yourselves. That's the end goal. And both are mitzvos. Sitting at the Seder, eating the matzah, eating the maror, telling over the Haggadah, is certainly a mitzvah. As well as the mitzvah of cleaning for Pesach. It's a mitzvah d'oraisa. It's a biblical mitzvah to get rid of chametz. And so both of these pictures represent mitzvos. The emotions, though, are not necessarily part of the mitzvah. On Yom Tov, we have an explicit commandment. We have an explicit mitzvah of Simchas Yantif or Oneg Yantif, that we're supposed to rejoice, with friends, with family, with good food, with drink, with clothing. We're supposed to have an atmosphere of happiness. There's no mitzvah to be sad, overworked, or happy for that matter, cleaning for Pesach, other than having the general Simcha Shel Mitzvah. And so I think one of the goals of this year is to enable us to fulfill both mitzvos as easily as possible and as seamlessly as possible, and to enable and facilitate a bigger Simchas and Oneg Yontif, and not so much of a headache leading up to it. On the flip side, though, Pesach, going back at least to the times of the Yerushalmi, has a very long tradition of being stringent, of either going above and beyond what is required, or perhaps following a more stringent opinion than we do during the year. And that is certainly taken into consideration, amongst other factors within the halachic calculus. The mashal that I like to give is if you compare Pesach and Sukkot, both have some halachos that govern food. You're not allowed to eat outside of the sukkah. And certainly on Pesach, there's a plethora of halachos that limit and restrict our diet and what we do with food and our relationship with food. And the mashal that I think is the best way to explain it is by taking a child. The very early stages of its development, we regulate very, very tightly what it eats, how much it eats. And then as it gets older, we become a little bit less strict in terms of what they eat, how much they eat, when they eat. It's not as regimented. So Pesach is the birth of Klal Yisrael. And so when we're forming The spiritual DNA of the Jewish people in its at its infancy stages were much more machmir than we might be at other points during the year. And it's always a balance of having those chumros and stringencies balanced against the ultimate simcha and oneg yontif that we're trying to have. Rabbi Willig is always famous for saying, "For every chumra, there is a kula. For every stringency that you take on yourself, you're being lenient about some other thing. It's inevitable. There's almost a Newtonian law of action and reaction." And so all of those factors are taken into account, and we'll try to do the best we can to balance them throughout this year and beyond. How do I go to the next slide? Okay, I guess I can't do that. Okay. General principles of kashering. If you look on the bottom right, this is a translation of a Hebrew phrase of kibolo kach polto, that just as something is absorbed, that method is the way to expunge it or purge whatever something has absorbed. And for all of you Lord of the Ring fans, that's Mount Doom. The one ring of power can only be unmade within the fires that forged it. The same thing is true when it comes to kashering. In general, throughout the year, our pots, pans, appliances, utensils have all absorbed chametz taste, chametz particles, according to halacha. And the way we expunge them is by subjecting them to the same process by which that chametz was absorbed. In general, halacha categorizes, aside from just this very superficial cleaning, four different ways of kashering. And we'll go in descending order of strength or harshness. So the strongest form of kashering is what's called libun or libun gamur, which is scouring something, typically a metal, until it is white hot. Nowadays, the most common ways of doing that are either by taking a blowtorch, which I strongly do not recommend except in one or maybe two circumstances, which I'll get to later. But the more common way that we do it now, in non-industrial settings in a house or an apartment, is with self-cleaning ovens. So we'll get to that. Libun has the distinction in terms of halacha compared to the other three methods of kashering in two ways. The first is that one does not need to wait 24 hours before kashering. All the other methods of kashering, which we'll get to, require the person to wait 24 hours from using that particular thing. So whether if you're kashering a sink, you cannot use the sink for 24 hours prior to kashering. If it's a utensil, you can't use that utensil 24 hours prior to kashering. If you do, you need to start the clock again. Libun, however, Libun Gomer does not require that. So if you have a self-cleaning oven, as we'll get to, you do not need to wait 24 hours. The other difference, which I would say I don't recommend doing for both halachic and practical reasons, is that libun technically does not need to be cleaned prior to the kashering process. If everything is incinerated, then you don't need to clean it because it is by definition incinerated, is no longer food. All the other methods of kashering require whatever is being kashered to be cleaned and thoroughly cleaned from any types of particles. That being said, if in a self-cleaning oven, which again is the most common method of kashering, I do recommend cleaning it with Easy Off. Easy Off is probably the most efficient way to clean anything that we'll be speaking about. For pragmatic reasons, it's just a lot easier to ensure that everything is actually incinerated. B, it lowers the chance of having grease fires or fires or bad smells in the oven. So for both of those reasons, I strongly recommend cleaning, even if you have a self-cleaning oven. The other three methods of kashering are what's called libun kal, which is heating to a high temperature, but not necessarily white hot. In halacha, it's the temperature of the incinerate paper. Again, that's more of a technical thing. We'll get to its applications. The most common one is in a non-self-cleaning oven, which we recommend turning to the highest temperature that's safely usable. I think typically that's like 550. That's the most common application of libun kal. Hagola is what we're doing in the shul, which is immersing the object in boiling water. So if you have a pot, or silverware that was essentially exposed to chametz in boiling water or in boiling liquid, like a pot, or if you're stirring something, or if you touch dry hot food on a superficial level, that's how you would kosher it. Another method is what's known as Eruy, which is taking boiling water and pouring it over something. So the most common application that we would have for that in a home kitchen would be a sink or a countertop if you're planning on koshering your countertop. That food, that those the countertop, the sink, those appliances come in contact with liquid being poured onto them. So you can kosher it just by simply pouring hot water onto them. As I said again, all those three, which are typically what people use to kosher, they need to be thoroughly cleaned beforehand. What does thoroughly cleaned mean? So it means quite simply, if there's any particles, they need to be removed. And if they can't, then it can't be kosher. However, what often happens, especially in ovens or in things that are put in an oven, is that you'll have stains from food that there's no, the Hebrew term is mamashus, that if you like rub your finger on it or if you rub like a knife on it, you won't actually pull off any residue. It's just a stain that's been cooked into the utensil. So that is fine. And the only thing that you need to clean are things that actually have mamashas to them. If you're able to rub your finger over it and you can't feel anything, that's totally fine. And once again, all of those three categories require that whatever you're koshering not be used for 24 hours. If you do accidentally, the clock needs to restart. Yes, okay. So somebody, Kenny, said that using Easy Off on a self-cleaning oven isn't recommended. Yes, I forgot about that. Yes, so I do recommend cleaning a self-cleaning oven prior to using it. Yes, I forgot. Using Easy Off is not recommended for a self-cleaning oven because the high temperature apparently reacts with it, and it could ruin the surface. So use something else. That is true. Thank you so much for reminding me. I appreciate that. Okay, next. Now let's get into more technical utensils. So ovens. Okay, so that's the easiest. Self-cleaning ovens versus standard ovens. So there's general to there are more types of ovens, but we'll just do those for now. Self-cleaning is easier. All you need to do is turn the oven on and run a self-cleaning cycle. The racks that are in there, some oven companies say to take them out when you do a self-cleaning oven because they might get ruined. That's your call. If you leave them in, then they can be koshered that way. If you don't and you take them out and you want to take them out during the self-cleaning cycle, they need to be koshered another way. So the other way that you can do it, if you're not doing Lieb und Gemüse, is to do Lieb und Kal, which is what we do for a standard oven anyway. So the standard oven, as well as racks that you do not kosher in the self-cleaning oven, you turn on the oven to the highest safe temperature, which again I think is typically 550, but again don't quote me on that. And you put it on, you keep it on that temperature. There's various opinions. What I was told is 40 minutes. Some people say 35 minutes. Various opinions within that range, I think, is acceptable. And you just leave it in there and then it's koshered. Just a reminder again, the oven, as well as racks that you're not using a self-cleaning oven for, need to be completely cleaned and wait 24 hours before using. If you have a convection oven, it's and you want to use the convection function over Pesach, that the fan needs to be cleaned as well. And when you kosher it, if you're using the Lieb und Kal method of just putting it on to the highest temperature, you have to do that with the convection fan on. I've never done that before. I can't speak to the practicality of it, but that is what would be required. Some ovens have hoods. And like a ventilation system. Various opinions as to how and if that needs to be koshered. Obviously, you want to have the oven ventilated and you want to have the hood operational. Oftentimes, those can be metal. And so I would recommend, if you want, you can expose it to steam. What's probably just easier, is to cover it with tin foil. But again, do not cover the actual ventilation bars. That will defeat the purpose and can ruin it. Now let's work on the top of the oven. So we have ranges. So on a standard gas range oven, I don't know how long those will be around in New York for, but generally now people have gas range stovetops. So the ranges themselves, so the entire surface should be completely cleaned. The grates on top, so if you see on this oven, they have grates that you put the pots on top. Some people have special Pesach ones. That's great. If you do not, those need to be thoroughly cleaned and kashered because, excuse me, they come into direct contact with chametz. So the best way to do that is if you have a self-cleaning oven, just put them in the self-cleaning oven. If you don't have one or you feel uncomfortable doing that. You can either put them, what's probably best is to, once again, clean the entire surface of the range, and then clean the grates. And again, don't use any of this for 24 hours, and then turn on the burners. You can do it one by one. You can do them all together. I wouldn't recommend it. And just have it again on the highest, for X amount of time, to do, Leibwohl Kal on the, grates, on the grates themselves. Another type of range are, oh, sorry, one more thing on the traditional ranges. What you've kashered, is just the area where you have made direct contact with the fire, which is namely the area right above it. You have not kashered the rest of the surface of the stovetop. It doesn't get hot enough. And so I don't recommend pouring boiling water on it. And so what I would recommend is covering the areas of the stovetop that are not covered by the grates, that food could potentially come in contact with, cover that with tin foil. Another type of range are electric ranges. Electric ranges are much more complicated to kosher, because the only part that gets hot is the actual surface of where the coil or the heating element is, as far as I know. So that part can be koshered once again by not using it for 24 hours, cleaning the surface, and then turning it onto its highest part. But once again, you've only koshered that particular area that's gotten hot for 35 to 40 minutes. The other thing is that you can't put tin foil on the surface, or you can't pour hot water on the surface to kosher it, and you can't put tin foil on it. Both of those methods will ruin the range, as far as I understand. You can reach out to me if you're in that situation. I think what people typically do is cover other areas with non-flammable stuff. People put like Pesach, people put like Pesach trivets on, or people put like trivets on it, or some other, decorative stones or anything that's fireproof to make sure that no food will come in contact with that. But again, it is very tricky. So if you're in that situation, please let me know and reach out, and I'll try to guide you as best as I can. And here we come to the one of two areas where I would actually recommend using a blowtorch if you have one. Broilers, not the broiler itself. The broiler itself is just the area. So that can be koshered again by either using the self-cleaning, if the self-cleaning function cleans the broiler. I don't think it typically does. Or doing the Leibwohl Kal method, which again is cleaning, waiting 24 hours, and turning it to its highest temperature for 35 to 40 minutes. That does not kosher the actual broiler plate, or wherever the food comes in contact with, because the food is coming in direct contact with it, so Leibwohl Kal doesn't work. You need to do Leibwohl Gemur. So what people typically do is, again, if you have a self-cleaning oven, theoretically you could put the broiler pan in there until it's completely, until it's completely incinerated. Or people take it outside the house, so there's no concern of fire, and will use a blowtorch to scour the broiler pan. Again, if you don't have experience doing it, I don't recommend it. I would just either get a separate kosher for Pesach broiling pan or don't use the broiler. But that is probably the one area where you could use a blowtorch to kosher something. If you do and you need guidance, I'm not good on the I've only really used it once or twice, so I would recommend going to somebody else for safety tips, but I can guide you in terms of the halachas. The other area, which again, I don't recommend doing, but where a blowtorch could theoretically be used, is for a grill. Again, grill gets ex food is directly put on the grill. They're notoriously difficult to clean. And even if you take a blowtorch and utterly incinerate it, it takes a very long time. I don't recommend doing it. If you're dead set on using a grill and you don't want to buy a new one for Pesach, let me know. But again, otherwise, do not use a blowtorch for anything. Warming drawers and toasters, really not recommended to kosher. They're very difficult to kosher warming drawers because they're not they don't reach a high enough temperature even for Libun Kal, and trying to do anything else to it would ruin it. Toasters, the food often comes in direct contact. Toaster ovens also are very difficult to clean and kosher because of the whole heat requirement. So we generally do not recommend koshering those for Pesach. Microwaves. Bit of a discussion as to how microwaves operate. Some people are machmir not to kosher them. There is definitely a very long-standing tradition of being mekel, and I would endorse that. Generally, if you want to kosher the microwave, especially when it comes to Pesach, for Pesach itself, I would not use the glass tray. Many microwaves have a glass tray. Ashkenazim are makpid, or machmir in many cases, not to kosher glass, for Pesach, and heat tempered glass is impossible to kosher, like Pyrex or anything like that. I would, if you want to use a microwave that has a glass dish, I would not use it. I would take out the glass dish. And then if you want to kosher the microwave, you would kosher it like you would any other time. Taking a container of water and microwaving it until it's filled with steam. Depending on the microwave, that takes, it could take anywhere from, 5 to 10 minutes. So really, or 5 to 15 minutes. So really, really just depends on your microwave. Essentially, bringing water to boil in the microwave for an extended period of time. Some people are machmir to do it twice and move it so that the steam can reach the bottom of where the plate or where the container was in the first time. If you want to be machmir on that, great. I will just caution you, don't microwave it for an extended period of time. I think somebody once told me they did it for like close to 20 minutes and the microwave broke. Don't do that. Sorry, someone just saw someone posted something in the chat. Could you double wrap the glass tray in the microwave? I guess you technically could. It would depend on what you would wrap it with. You can't use tin foil, so you'd have to use, I guess, like plastic wrap that would warp. Maybe I just don't know of a certain substance that could be used. I guess theoretically, if you could find something that's microwave safe with plastic wrap, I don't know if that's such a good thing to do, especially if you're trying to put it back onto the rotating disc. I wouldn't recommend it. Maybe it's possible. I don't know. I just would not recommend it. Okay, I think we got through everything here. Sinks. Okay, so this is, I guess this was not from a Jewish website, but this looks like it could be a kosher kitchen with a milchig and fleishig. So this sink is made with metal. It's a stainless steel. It is a stainless steel sink surrounded by a non-metal countertop. So once again, when it comes to metal is kosherable, and So you send because it comes in contact with hot chametz being poured onto it. Therefore, you can use irui. You can pour hot water. So the sinks and all the surfaces that you're kashering needs to be thoroughly cleaned and not used for 24 hours. And then you pour hot water. You have to make sure that when you pour the hot water, it comes in contact with every part of the surface that you're kashering. If you have a normal, if you live in a normal residential setting, and that can take a while. Some people ask this year about using a steamer. It's complicated. There are only a few non-industrial steamers that work, and they're often expensive. If you want to invest in one, that's great. You can look in the Halacha chat for the information there of the one that I found that is recommended. We're going to work with the non-steaming, the non-steamer track, because I think that's the scenario that most people are in. When you say not used for 24 hours, can it be used with cold water in that time? Yeah, so that's the million-dollar question that everybody asks. The technical answer is yes. That being said, it has to be ice cold because there are various opinions on what hot means, and we're machmir, especially when it comes to Pesach, to really not meddle with that, and it has to be like really ice cold. And for that reason, it's just lechadchila, I would say don't use it at all. If someone accidentally turns on the cold water and is
I did not get a hug.
So but if somebody accidentally turns it on and it's ice cold, I don't think you need to restart the clock. But in general, we are machmir not to use it even with cold. B'di'evet, we can be, I would certainly make ill. Sorry, again, just a reminder of everybody, if you're not actively asking a question, if you could just mute just so everybody else is able to hear. In terms of just tips, just some tips about doing Eroy without a steamer. So the typical way that I would recommend that people do is to use one, or probably two is more efficient, kettles. If you have an electric kettle and you just bring the water to a boil, you can do that in a couple of minutes and just keep pouring the hot water on whatever surfaces you are until you're done. Just a reminder about what it means to do irui, to pour boiling water. It means that the water has to be actively boiling and bubbling at the time that it makes contact with whatever surface you're kashering. Does a Shabbos urn get hot enough to use? Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that later. When it comes to using a kettle, what often happens is that for the first X number of seconds, it's boiling and then it cools down, goes below 212. Apparently, the Israeli ones, from what I heard, last longer because the Israelis are not as concerned for safety. But American ones will typically cool down after a couple of seconds that you've taken it off, or you've unplugged it, or you've taken it off the heating element. So therefore, when you're kashering, you really only have a couple of seconds for the water to make contact with whatever you're kashering. So first of all, please be safe. It can lead to burns. I burnt myself last night. Baruch Hashem, I'm fine. But again, please be careful. What it also means is that you'll probably be doing this in multiple steps. You'll be doing a piecemeal of bringing the kettle to boil several times and just koshering it part by part. That's just how the process works. Other components of the sink that you need to remember to kosher are the surface of the faucet where the water comes out. You have to try to kosher that as well, or replace the top. Some people have like an aerator, so I would replace that. But otherwise, there's nothing to replace. You have to kosher that as well. If the nozzle extends, sometimes the faucet's nozzle extends. Assuming that it's a metal surface, Again, safely, I would counter that as well. The strainer or the drain part. So obviously it needs to be cleaned, but it's typically very hard to clean and get water and get boiling water into all of the holes of a strainer. Sometimes there's also a non-metal component which could potentially complicate it for koshering purposes. So therefore, if it's at all possible, we recommend either not using or getting new drain covers or strainers or anything with little holes in it, of just either getting new ones or not using it for Pesach. Some people use inserts for that reason as well. That's all if you have metal. If you do not have metal, if it's a non-kosherable surface, we'll get to surfaces a little bit later, but if you have a non-metal or a non-kosherable surface, there's no way to kosher it. So what that means is you have one or two options. One is to get inserts for Pesach. The other is to completely cover the entire sink with something, with some other material. You could use tin foil. It's a lot of tin foil, but also unless you have very heavy duty tin foil, it could often rip, so it needs to be reinforced. And it also has to be reinforced with something that's waterproof. So therefore, it's probably really just easier to get inserts and then to, cover other potentially exposed areas. That brings us to the next topic, which is surrounding surfaces as well. Do faucet hands also need to be koshered by Irui? I guess technically it depends where it is. If there's some other place in the kitchen, then theoretically not. But oftentimes it's right near the sink. So yes, in general, I would recommend pouring the hot water on it. If you're afraid that something's going to rust or get damaged, just cover it. You can cover it with tin foil or cover it with something else. But yeah, if it's close to the sink, I would recommend koshering. What we've spoken up until now, though, is the sink itself. Oftentimes, as in this sink in the picture, there's a lip. So as the very, very top part of the sink has a non-metal surface. It's sort of an extension or a spillover of the border of the countertop. And if the countertop is not kosherable, it needs to be covered. So even if you're koshering the sink, if it has a border of a non-kosherable thing, a non-kosherable material, that would need to be covered as well. So let's go to that now. Countertops. So there are a number of surfaces I've tried. This is from the, I think this is from the Starkey list. There's always a new type of substance. Can't guarantee I've encountered them all. Kosherable ones, granite, marble, and we're talking about pure ones, not with like resin or composite. Stainless steel, metal, wood. I don't know too many wood countertops, but sometimes there are. All of those are kosherable using Irui. Once again, by taking a kettle first and preceded by cleaning it and waiting 24 hours. Non-kosherable materials, silestone, porcelain, enamel, corian, quartz, plastic, formica, and granite composite. Granite composite is a machlokas. Some people are machmir, some people are mekel. I was taught to be machmir. If you follow somebody that's mekel, if you know somebody that's your posek, you can follow that. But those are non-kosherable materials. So that needs to be covered. Assuming that you're putting something hot on it or something hot came onto it throughout the year. So basically, if it's in the kitchen, if it's non-kosherable, it needs to be covered. How can it be covered? Again, generally we use tin foil. One thing that I've used in the past for very large surfaces, is just buying a piece of like buying it just like a piece of plastic, which you can cut to size. You can reuse it from year to year. So if you have like an island or just a large flat countertop area, you can, or even a small one, you can just buy a piece of plastic, cut it down to size, and use it year to year. But once again, all parts of the surface need to be completely covered. Other cleaning and kashering. So utensils, obviously, if you have utensils made from the kasherable materials, those need to be kashered. They can't be. Glass. Someone asked me about glass. And so you don't usually have typically glass utensils, but we do have glass cups. This is a difference between Ashkenazim and Sfardim. Sfardim are mekel to kasher glasses. Ashkenazim generally are machmir. That being said, if there is a significant financial loss, a hefsed meruba, or if they have sentimental value, or if they haven't been used in like, you know, a couple of decades or something like that, we can be mekel on, you know, a one-time basis, so to speak, and kasher them by putting them in boiling water or something like that. Again, I wouldn't do that without consulting your local Orthodox rabbi. You can reach out to Rabbi Zirkin or to myself. In general, we're not. In certain scenarios, if there's a hefsed meruba, or if, again, sentimental value, or they haven't been used in a lot, in a very, very, very long time, we can be mekel. Tablecloths. So if you have a cloth or a cloth tablecloth that you use throughout the year that you want to use for Pesach, it certainly has chametz. It certainly needs to be cleaned and kashered. How is it cleaned and kashered? So typically, the earliest source we have on kashering tablecloths is from the Magen Avraham and his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, where he says that if you put it in, you know, boiling water and beat it around, it's kosher. Essentially, you're doing hagala with the tablecloth. So Rav Moshe says that washing machines certainly fulfill that requirement. So if you put it in a washing machine in hot water and you use detergent, it's totally fine. But again, just make sure that it's completely clean. I will say there are some very new washing machines that have in economy or environmental friendly mode, which uses cold water. I would be machmir not to do that. I think in most apartment buildings, they have not been updated. And so the standard setting is to use hot water. If you know that it uses cold water, don't use that washing machine, or turn it to a higher setting that uses hot water. Refrigerators do not need to be kashered. They do need to be cleaned, though. How do you clean a refrigerator? So people will scrub it down with some spray, with towel paper. We use a lot of towel paper or rags over the next few days and weeks. So you have to scrub it down. Some people line their refrigerators. Is that required? So let me just try to outline what the prohibition of chametz is and the concern again, because we're not dealing with kashering, we're just dealing with cleaning. So there are several prohibitions revolving around chametz. One is owning and seeing chametz. So owning and seeing chametz, the shear or the requirement to incur the pro to transgress the avera is a kizayis. Is an olive's worth. That being so, if you have a couple of crumbs hidden away somewhere that you didn't find, or even if you did find and you don't clean it out, that's not an aveira if it's not the size of a kezias. However, that's just the prohibition of owning chametz. The prohibition of eating chametz is on a mashu. It's even on the very smallest amount. And so when it comes to just, you know, the floor of a house, so, okay, you know, you sweep and you do the best you can and you do bedikas chametz, but if you, you don't need to line the floors, that's okay. When we're dealing with things that food comes in direct contact with, some people are extra machmir. If there are any crumbs, in the refrigerator that the food comes in contact with and you eat it, you didn't intend to, so it's a shogeg, so it's not that bad, but it's still an aveira. So that's why certain people are machmir, especially in areas where, you know, food comes in direct contact with it. So like the vegetable drawer, the produce drawer here, right? So apples, we eat an apple with the peel. And so theoretically, that could be That could be ingesting fomites if there's any crumbs that fell there from a higher level, or if you have crumbs from anywhere else in the refrigerator that got stuck onto the surfaces of the bottles or the yogurts that you put on the table. It could lead to people ingesting chametz. That's why some people are mafmir. Strictly speaking, do you need to do that? The answer is no. Especially if you're careful and you do a thorough cleaning. You do not need to line your refrigerators. That might sound heretical to people. But you, strictly speaking, do not need to. Again, if you want to, there's certainly room to be machmir. And it's always nice if you have the time to do it. What you do need to do is to make sure that it is thoroughly, completely cleaned. I don't know how many times I myself personally, or I've heard stories. Oh yeah, I had no idea how that, how those cake crumbs or the crumb topping that I made for the cake had fallen into the produce drawer, that crack behind the produce drawer. It's there. So you really do need to do a very thorough cleaning of the refrigerator and freezer. Someone asked, if you only have one refrigerator for non-kosher LePesach items that are not chametz gamur, i.e. kidney oats, etc., is it acceptable to keep in the fridge and just cover tape over on the door? So if you have non-chametz gamur, so obviously chametz needs to be getting rid of. If you're selling it, we'll get to that later. I don't recommend it. Just, I really don't recommend it, of keeping it there and just demarcating it. But if that's your only option, that's your only option. The prohibition of kidney oats is eating it, not owning it. So it's certainly fine from a halachic perspective to put it in the to keep it in the fridge. From just a practical, realistic perspective, though, it's very easy for somebody to, if you have a kidney oats non-kosher LePesach ketchup, that's kidney oats, and you accidentally grab it, it's very easy. So if it is thoroughly covered, or taped over or demarcated, I don't see a problem. I don't think it's a halachic issue. It's just more of a practical thing. I wouldn't recommend it, but if that's the only way that you can do it, just be very careful. And it should be fine. Urns. So I'm working on the assumption that it is a metal urn. So metal urns typically bring water to boil. So do that. I would wait 24 hours. Thoroughly clean it out. Some people boil it with vinegar, just for not even for kosher purposes, but just to clean it. You could do that too, as a cleaning method. But regardless, afterwards you need to put in water and come, bring it to a boil. And then I would also do Eruy, simply because since it's a huge amount of water, you don't know if the boiling water has been completely interacted with all surfaces of the urn. So you can certainly bring it to a boil, but I would just do Eruy on it as well. That's for the surf. That's for the urn itself. What about the spigot? So if the spigot is metal, that could be kashered using Eruy as well. If it's not metal, if it's plastic is not kasherable. And so I would cover if you can find a replacement. I don't think they usually have replacements, though. I don't think they have, I don't think you can unscrew it, but you can and you have a spare, that's great. If you don't, cover whatever surface is possible of the spigot and the nozzle with tinfoil or something like that. Other non-kitchen related cleaning. Cars need to be cleaned. There's always going to be something that you find hidden somewhere. It should be cleaned. If you have a work office that you have personal items, also need to be cleaned. People posted chats. Can one use regular Shabbos plata be used for Pesach? So you can. It needs to be kashered. So like the warming tray thing, it doesn't usually get hot enough on its own. Really the only way that I know of is to pour boiling water on it. And again, first of all, cleaning it, waiting 24 hours, and to pour boiling water on all the surfaces that it comes in contact with. People have commented that it could potentially damage the plaza. I've done it. It hasn't damaged it. I'm not saying that it doesn't. That's the only way that I know to kosher it. Maybe there are other ways. But just simply turning it on and keeping it as hot as possible, it's not hot enough. So you would need to do Iru on it. Someone asked if you're planning to boil water in a pot to kosher the sink, do you have to use a chametz pot or a pesach pot? Do you kosher the stove first? So here's where the whole chumrah thing comes. So some people do have a chumrah to use a kosher for Pesach pot. If you have that option, that's great. It's not required. It's certainly not required. And do you have to kosher the stovetop first? No, same thing. Again, some people are machmir. You do not need to do that. It is not necessary. Yes, I will get to what we'll do with people being away over Chag. One person asked, "What do we need to clean?" So we'll get to that. We'll get to that at some point. Places. So just the last thing on this slide. Places that you do not need to check. So the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch are very clear. You do not need to check places where no chametz
Right.
has ever been brought. So what does that mean? That means never. If it's always except for oh that one time, there's generally a second time that it happened as well. Especially if you're in an apartment, I really would just recommend checking the entire and cleaning the entire apartment. If you have a basement that you never ever bring food into, so you don't need to check that. If you have a place at work that you never bring food to, you don't need to check it, even if it's your own personal office, if you never bring food there. That being said, don't underestimate the creativity of anybody in bringing chametz, especially little children. Chametz will just inevitably, it's like an airborne, it's just like airborne particles. It just diffuses over every surface area that it has access to. So again, if there's like this attic or basement that you never use, or never bring food into, you don't need to check. Otherwise, I would. That being said, other areas that you don't need to clean are places that aren't accessible. Meaning, if you have, if there's a Cheerio that fell into your car, into the area of this track of the seat, and you can't get it and you can't access it with a vacuum or a spray or anything like that, if it's completely inaccessible, the Gemara says if a wall collapses on something, the chametz is still there, the chametz is still edible, but you can't access it. So if it is completely inaccessible, you do not need to, you don't need to worry about it. Again, but oftentimes places are accessible. It's again, if behind that radiator that you just can't ever reach, or in that hole in the car that you can't ever, stick your
Yeah,
finger into,
put in my ears.
then it's okay. You don't need to kosher it. You don't need to clean it, rather. You just move on. Medicine on Pesach. So just a quick overview. There's three types of cholim. There are three types of people that are ill. Cholishigesh posakana, somebody that is has a life-threatening condition, either actively involved in a life-threatening condition, or is in a scenario that could theoretically lead to a life-threatening condition if immediate action is not taken. For example, diabetes. You regulate, if you're regulated, then you're not in any life-threatening situation. However, if certain steps are not taken, that could very quickly deteriorate into a cholishigesh posakana situation. So that's one category. The second category is cholishein posakana, a chola, somebody ill that does not have a life-threatening disease. What that is generally the way the Gemara explains it, and the way the Shulchan Aruch paskens is if you have a very severe either headache or a part of your body or your entire body feels so debilitated that you're bedridden. Or the way it was taught to me is that if you are so debilitatingly ill that you cannot function normally. That's the second category. No life-threatening disease, but you're bedridden, you can't function. The third category is the least severe, which is known as mechush. It just it bothers you. You have a headache, or your hand hurts, or something like that. So obviously, a cholish yesh bo sakana, somebody that's in a life-threatening situation or something that could very quickly, if not properly treated, deteriorate to a life-threatening situation. Obviously, you're allowed to do whatever you need in terms of Pesach and Chametz. Mechush ba'alma, the other end of the spectrum. I'm sorry. It might bother you, but you have to only use kosher for Pesach medicine. The middle category is where this whole discussion comes up of a chole she'ein bo sakana, where somebody is not feeling well and is either bedridden or is so debilitated that they can't function normally. Oftentimes, infants or very, very young children fall into this category just because of how sensitive they are. So let's just go through it piece by piece. Can you have chametz gomer? Can you actually have chametz? The answer is no. If there's no life-threatening scenario, you cannot have chametz. What about kitnios? Kitnios, yes. If you are a chole she'ein bo sakana, you are allowed to have kitnios. So where does that leave us? What does that mean? There are typically two types of medicines, or I guess three types of medicines, liquids, solids, and then more complex solids that are, have capsules or are chewables, or more food-like, basically. If it's just a straight pill, most straight pills are not considered to be halachically food, certainly don't have chametz, or 99% of them don't have chametz at all. Some of them have kitnios, some of them don't. In general, you can take pills. Something more complex, like a chewable or a gummy or things that have taste, also like kids' medicine that has flavor, or liquids. Liquids in general were more machmir, in terms of categorizing it as food and its edibility. So that we're more machmir about. So again, if it's just kitnios, then theoretically it's fine. If you have the option of having a one that's completely kosher for Pesach, obviously you should have that. But if you don't, then you can have one that's kitnios. But every once in a while, you do have to be careful about chametz products being mixed into liquids or the chewables or more complex edible stuff. In terms of where to look, there is a Starkey list of many medicines. It's on the RJC website. Happy to share the link with people afterwards on the Halacha chat. It's very, very thorough. I can't guarantee it has everything. So just very practically, first of all, if you're on medication, don't change anything before consulting with a doctor. It's just a bad thing to do. So don't do anything without consulting a doctor. Once you have consulted a doctor about what you can and should not do, and you want to check medicine, it's always good to check to see if it's kosher or Pesach, because if you have the option of having something that's completely kosher for Pesach versus kitnios, so do the kosher for Pesach, do the completely kosher for Pesach one. So look at the Starkey list. If it's in the last minute, it's Erev Pesach or it's on Pesach and you're not, and it's not over Yontif, and you're not able to check the list. You're not able to call. Like I said, in general, most pills are totally fine. Again, you should try to check beforehand. You obviously should try to consult a doctor beforehand. If you're in a pinch, you can generally take them. Again, if it's chewables, I would, or if it's more food-like, I would hesitate more. Vitamins on Pesach. In general, again, if you're a healthy person and you're just taking a supplement, or if it's a prenatal supplement, for standard cases, they often contain kitnios, and the people that are taking them in most cases are not considered to be a chole she'ein bo sakana. It's generally just a mechush ba'olma, and what the vitamins contribute would only help in terms of a mechush, if that. Therefore, vitamins, unless you find one that's completely kosher for Pesach, generally we don't recommend having them over Pesach, because in general they do have kitnios. Again, if there are special circumstances, obviously please feel free to reach out. Let me Would medicine, yeah, right. So the question is, is medicine roi lafi las kalos? So that's a very big distinct discussion as to what is considered to be edible by dogs or not. So in general, the reason why we're may kill, if you don't know or if you're in a pinch, is simply because we can rely on the opinion that it's not roi lafi las kalos, that it's not edible by dogs. That being said, there are opinions that have a different conception of it, a very respectable poskim, and there's a very long history, historical tradition of being machmir for that. So that's why I said, if you have the option of checking beforehand, it's certainly good. If you're not able to verify, either because it's not on the list, or you're not able to find out, or you don't have access to anything else, you can certainly be makel and can certainly take it. That's the basic guideline. So again, just to reiterate, do not do anything in terms of altering medication without consulting a doctor. It's best to look at medicine stuff beforehand. In general, if it's a straight up pill, it shouldn't be a problem. And even if it has kidneys, if it's a chol she'en bo sakana, you can have it anyway. Like I said, in general, straight up pills are fine. If we're dealing with more complex things or liquids, if it's a chole she'en bo sakana, in general, it's okay. You do need to check in terms of if there's actual chametz mamish in it. With pills, it's not often the case. And so again, you can be makil. But if you don't know, but it's always best to check first. Vitamins, we're generally machmir not to have. Infants or young children. So infants in general, as I said, have a status of a chole she'en bo sakana. So what does that mean? It means that they can have kidneys. Children or infants that are on formula, oftentimes formula has kidneys in it. So you shouldn't have it if you're a healthy adult. If it's an infant and that's what they that's the type of formula that they have, and again, don't try to change it in the last second because sometimes babies don't use a particular formula. It just doesn't work. I wouldn't recommend, only stocking up on that and throwing out everything else or locking up everything else. If you have the option of using a non a non-kidneys versus a kidneys, obviously go with the non-kidneys version. But if kidneys is the only one that works, or that's the only one that works most effectively, so okay, that's fine. What does that mean practically, though? Just because the baby can ingest it doesn't mean that you can. So if you're using formula that has kidneys, and again, there are lists, should be on the RJC website, either through the OU or the Star K. So if you're using formula that has kidneys, whatever comes in contact with it, bottles, nipples, whatever, utensils, whatever is involved, or pots to heat it up, whatever comes in direct contact with the kidneys, should be cleaned, and it should be prepared in an area that does not come in contact with food that everyone else eats. The common practice that I'm familiar with is people will typically clean it and have special heating stuff. I don't think that's necessary, but that's certainly for cleaning in a bathroom sink. That's what people typically do. Now let's deal with the actual bottles and feeding equipment. So somebody asked me this earlier in the halacha chat. So strictly speaking, so sometimes the equipment is plastic or glass, which means that it's not kasherable. So first of all, does it need to be kashered in general? So if it just comes in contact with kidneys, then the answer is no. It doesn't need to be kashered. If you wash it with other chametz with hot water, so then yes, it strictly speaking would need to be kashered. If it's made of kasherable material, great. If it's not, and typically they're not made with kasherable material, it's better. It's very nice to have a separate set of Pesach baby utensils. And I do know many people that have that. At the same time, it's expensive. It's logistically complicated. There is certainly room to be makel, and what I advised in the halacha chat is that one can be makel. One does not need to buy a separate set. You don't need to line anything with tinfoil or anything like that. If you have the option of having a separate pay stub, that's great. But again, every chumrah has a kula. So if you're spending more money on this instead of being able to be mekayim Simchas Yom Tov at all, or to pay yeshiva tuition, I'm obviously exaggerating. You have to make a cost benefit analysis. So in general, it's better to be machmir, but again, everything comes at a cost. And there is certainly, I repeat, there is certainly room to be mekel. High chairs and other utensils. High chairs really need to be cleaned thoroughly. Many people have the custom of lining it with something. I think that's a good practice. Is it absolutely necessary? Probably not, because the stuff that the baby eats is typically not that hot. You never know. It could be hot, and so I think it's a good practice to line. You don't need to line the entire high chair, even though many surface areas of the high chair come in contact with food, even though they're not supposed to. The tray itself, where the baby will, eat from and put it on there and lift it up and eat it, that is it should be lined. Utensils, again, if they came in contact with chametz, they need to be kashered. Let's say they don't have let's say it's not made of kosherable material. Let's say it's plastic or something like that, or rubber. So those materials are not kosherable. So if you have the option of having, dedicated Pesach utensils that the infant can use, either the ones that everybody else is using or you have another set, that's great. If you can't, then that's a little bit trickier. Please reach out to me. I'm happy to try to be of help. In terms of toys, children's toys are a repository for chametz. They just are. And also kids have a tendency to eat things that they find over the course of Pesach. So toys that young children use very much need to be cleaned. If you don't want to be bothered with cleaning them, you can put them away. You can sell them. I'm not saying that the child shouldn't have toys, but whatever you're planning on using for Pesach, they should be thoroughly cleaned and checked beforehand. Traveling. A couple of questions that come up in terms of traveling. The first is bedikas chametz. When do you check? Depends on when you're leaving. So if you're leaving on Erev Yontif or after the nightfall of Erev Yontif, meaning after bedikas chametz time, so you are obligated to check your apartment or your house, wherever you're leaving, you're obligated to check it with the bracha. If one person left early and another person is still there, whoever's home should check on behalf of the entire household with the bracha on the night of bedikas chametz. If you're leaving beforehand, if you're still here now, if it's less than 30 days from Pesach and you leave a couple days in advance or basically more than a day in advance, you do need to check. You do need to do a bedikah. Ideally, you should do it at night with, ideally you should do it at night with a flashlight. However, you do not do a bracha. You do not make a bracha with it. In terms of mechiras chametz, if you want to sell stuff, the shul has been selling chametz, Rabbi Zirkin and myself. There's also forms online. So mechiras chametz, there are two different forms depending on where you're traveling to. If you're traveling to Israel or essentially abroad anywhere, not in this hemisphere, I recommend using, we have an international form which sells it a day early. So you would fill that one out. If you're flying domestic, you can fill out the standard one. Once again, I have forms, Rabbi Zirkin has forms, they're online as well. Most chitim, there's often a minhag to give tzedakah before Pesach, known as most chitim. It's a very long-standing custom for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. The shul strongly encourages everybody to give what they can, because it is not an obligation but merely a custom. One is allowed to use Meisr money for it. Donations can be made online through the shul on the shul website, or can be given in person to Rabbi Zirkin or myself. Okay, before we get to the next part, let's talk about what happens when you sell. So when you sell, if you're selling the entire apartment, all you need to do is just lock up the place and let Rabbi Zirkin or myself know where the non-Jew is able to access the key and enter the apartment. If you're selling portions of the house, either cabinets or rooms or closets, that's fine. You need to delineate what areas you are selling, and you also need to mark them off because they're not yours. Anything will do. You can tape it, you can hang up a sign, you can do whatever you want. There should be a demarcation. That's just the strict halacha requirements. You also need to remind yourself not to eat it. Once happened, somebody sold a microwave and they forgot to tape it up, and they accidentally use it over Pesach just by instinct, and they trifed up a bunch of kalim. And they trifed up a bunch of stuff. So the strict halacha requirement is just to show that it's not yours. Practically speaking, though, do whatever is necessary to make sure nobody uses it. Another point, checking a new location. Let's say you are visiting somebody for Pesach. If they're Jewish, hopefully they've done a bedikah, so you don't need to. If you're going to a hotel, if you arrive before on Pesach and you're acquiring the hotel, you need to do a bedikah. If it's before Pesach, you would do it with a bracha. If it's on Pesach, you don't. You do need to do a bedikah, though. You should have in mind to not acquire any chametz, and if you find chametz, it should be destroyed immediately. But you do need to do a bedikah because you are assuming ownership of the room, or renting the room at least. Just something to remember. Again, you don't need to use a candle or anything like that, but you do need to do a thorough check. Post Pesach. So when it comes to after Pesach, as crazy as that sounds, Pesach will come to an end. After Pesach, you are only allowed to access the chametz that you sold once the non-Jew sells it back to the community. That typically happens shortly after Pesach. I think generally it's within 2 hours afterwards. The shul will be in contact. But just a reminder that just because you make havdalah doesn't mean you can immediately rush to, have a bowl of cereal. You do have to wait a certain amount of time until the chametz is bought back. And once again, the shul will let you know. In terms of buying products, after Pesach. So assuming that the chametz in stores has been sold or it has been owned by a non-Jew, it's fine. You can buy it back. You can buy it immediately after Pesach. If it was owned or has a controlling interest by Jews that did not sell the chametz, that is chametz avar lav Pesach, and one should not buy it. The shul, I believe, has a list of local proprietors that you can buy from immediately after Pesach. So be on the lookout for that. Once again, I just want to reiterate, Ichag Kasher V'Sameach to everybody. There are just one or two questions which people emailed, which I did not get to, and I will do so now. But just because the presentation is over, and we traditionally wish people Ichag Kasher V'Sameach, we want people to have a kosher Pesach, and we want people to have a happy Pesach. So I'll just share a quick story, with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. So someone on Pesach night, the first night of Pesach, Yaakov Kamenetsky lived at Muncie at the time, and so everybody was wishing a good yontif to him. So a boy came and wished him Chag Kasher V'Sameach. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky corrected him, and he said that before Pesach, we wish everybody that they should have a kosher Pesach. Once Pesach starts, we assume that every yid is kosher, and now we just focus on having a Chag Sameach. And that's true too. That there are two pictures here. There's the working, there's the groaning, there are the tears, there's the happy faces. There's a range of emotions, and we all go through them preparing for Pesach. That's a means to an end. And the most important thing is to have a happy Pesach and not only have a kosher Pesach. And Simchas Yom Tov is a biblical mitzvah. So should we remember to have that as well? So let me just get to people posted in the chat. I will get to that as well. I just want to answer some of the email questions that people sent me. So let me just open them up to make sure that I have everything. Let me just look over here. Formica, we've done. We did about koshering ovens. Can you kosher on Chol HaMoed? No, you can't. Well, I mean, you can kosher, but you can't really. It would be challenging. If it's a particular issue about koshering something on Chol HaMoed, let me know. I will try to guide you as best I can. Very, very much not recommended. Are paper goods chametz? In general, not. In general, not. They could be lined with stuff. I don't think in general. I'm happy to look into it. I believe there are, dedicated kosher for Pesach paper goods that you can find on lists. So if you want to be machmir, you can. I don't think one needs to be super machmir about that. Classes, we talked about hot plate, we talked about fridge, we talked about medicine cabinet, microwaves, and cloth tablecloths. So we did that. Other questions. Sink, kettle, oven, stovetop, did all that. Medication. Okay, so we did all of that. So I'm just going through all the emails. Somebody asked about the history of Gebracht. So it evolved probably during the late middle early modern period in Europe, especially amongst Hasidim. People were concerned about there being components of matzah that hadn't been completely cooked. Again, cooking methods were not as good. If you want to go to the rabbi's shiur on Shabbos HaGadol, and talks about the history of machine matzahs, you can learn about some subpar matzah cooking methods in Europe. So that was basically where it came about, and there were also concerns, just again because of lack of sanitary or proper cleaning and protocols, that grains of chametz would be in other products, and if they would be exposed to water or liquid, they could potentially become chametz. So many families now have a custom not to dip matzah or matzah meal or anything and mix it with liquid over Yontif, except for making matzah, where we, wait 18 minutes. That's generally the history of Gebracht. In terms of the history of the Seder, that was also what someone asked about, how the Seder evolved. So there's a very early version in the Mishnah. So there was a form of the Seder, certainly all of the mitzvos of the Seder, and the earliest part of the Haggadah text, the Psukim that we say. That was probably the earliest that evolved, either by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola or during the second Beis HaMikdash period. And then more parts were added over time. So after the Beis HaMikdash, in the times of the Mishnah, and then in the Gemara, the text of the Ma'anish Tana was changed. There were a Halach Ma'anya was added, and then other piyutim of Nirtzeh were added even later. The vast majority of the Seder was around during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, but as the history of the Jewish people unfolded, certain parts were changed, like Ma'anish Tana. Certain parts were added, like the introductory passages that we say, and then and even later, piyutim were added by Nirtzeh. How tips for cleaning a car? Go to a car wash place. Oftentimes they have vacuums there, or use another vacuum. You can use vacuum at home, and you just have to clean it. If it's really, really difficult, you have to do the best you can. There really are large, pieces of chametz that one will be biblically over bal yiro and bal yemetzah on. So I really advocate doing as long, doing as thorough a job as possible. If you have a regular small, if you have a regular sedan, and it's just you, it can take a while. But you do need to clean it. That being said, you don't need to go overboard. If it's a little crumb, in the corner, and it's, you can't really get it, that's fine. You don't need to actually give it a car wash. You don't need to wax the car, but you really do need to just, vacuum and clean it. In terms, some people have accustomed to line areas like a console area where they put food. That's great. But if you don't, I think that's okay too. Now let's get to the questions on the chat. If I kosher my kitchen before Pesach, can I cook kitnios in my Pesach pots before the chag starts? It's a good question. In general, I think that's I think that's okay. I'll double check just because I don't think I've had that that Shiloh before. I just want to make sure, but I'm pretty sure that's okay. I wouldn't recommend it, but I'm pretty sure that's okay. And but again, I want to make sure, so I will get back to you on that, and I will certainly share a recording. Next question: can I use my oven to kosher my stove grates without doing a deep clean? Can I use my oven to kosher my stove grates without doing a deep clean on the oven? I'm assuming by deep clean you mean the self-cleaning feature. So the answer is yes. I'm sorry. Yes, so I believe you can. You can just put them in the oven to the highest temperature. It probably, though, I think is better. I think it's more optimal because it really will come just in direct contact with the flame. So it's a better standard of koshering, just to put on the burner. And again, it doesn't need to be for super long. 20 minutes, I think, should be fine. Because that's a real direct flame. Reminder to empty out the vacuum cleaner before Pesach. Yes, that is a very good point. Even if you have an entire trash can full of chametz sitting in your house, that's still a problem. And because it accumulates, it can reach the size of a keziah. So yes, please, please, please do remember to throw out your chametz vacuum cleaner bags that you've used. Can I use napkin rings on Pesach that I have used during the year? Look, strictly speaking, if it hasn't come in contact with anything hot, if you've thoroughly cleaned it, I guess the answer is yes. They've been on the table, so it's very likely that they have come in contact with something hot. If there's cholent, then the cholent falls on it, or if they've been washed in a hot sink with chametz. So if it's metal, you can kosher it. If it's non-kosherable, I wouldn't recommend it. Again, technically speaking, it's probably okay. I personally wouldn't recommend it though, just because you never know, and there is a likelihood that it has come in contact with something chametz. So yes, I will record. I am recording, and so I will share this with people. In terms of the link to the Starkey medicine list, if you give me a second, I will try to find it to share it with people now. If you give me 1 second, let's find this. So first of all, here is the RJC Pesach section, which is always good to have. And then in terms of the specifically the medicine guide, where is it? Here it is. Yeah, so this is the guide to medications and cosmetics. I will put that here. Okay. And so again, thank you everybody for joining. If anybody has any questions now, please feel free to unmute or use the chat feature. And as always, you can post in the Halacha chat or email me privately. It's busy. I can't guarantee I will get back to you instantaneously, but I will try to get back to you as soon as possible. My pleasure. Thank you all for coming and Nechag Kasher v'Sameach.
Thank you.
All right.